Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
More than 4,000 people have died after an earthquake hit Turkey and Syria in the early hours yesterday. The US Geological Survey measured Monday's quake at a magnitude of 7.8 with a depth of 11 miles. Hours later, a 7.5 magnitude quake struck more than 60 miles away. The NHS is preparing for further disruption to services as nurses walk out again in their disputes over pay. Health leaders say the service is anticipating an incredibly disrupted week as it faces strikes by nurses, ambulance staff and physiotherapists. Monday saw the largest strike in NHS history as tens of thousands of workers in England staged walkouts. And the chief executive of a specialist diving team assisting in the search for Nicola Bulley said he's very surprised that she's not been found in river searches. The underwater search is continuing today as the search for Nicola enters its 11th day. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Sophia Lewis-Hobbs.
Okay, James, I need you to do a few more drops than yesterday, I'm afraid.
Carl needs to find another driver for his expanding courier business. Someone who'll really help to lighten the load.
Any issues, give me a call.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do.
South today, what about you?
Indeed helps you quickly attract, screen and virtually interview great candidates, all through an easy-to-use dashboard. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
Colourful, coming up next, colourful, Julius colourful radio.
I test because HIV can affect anyone.
I test because HIV testing is quick, confidential and free.
I test because it's the only way to know if I have HIV. If positive, I can get straight onto treatment. If negative, I get peace of mind.
It's National HIV Testing Week. Order your free HIV test at startswithme.org.uk.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, colorful.com and apps. This is Colorful Radio. Colorful Radio.
Africa in Focus is sponsored by Dermadew Lotion. Visit dermashark.co.uk.
Colorful Radio.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, depending on the time zone you are listening to us from or even watching us. Welcome to Africa in Focus. This is Julius Baluto. I'm your host. And today in the studio, we are privileged and very happy indeed to host my great friend and great Kenyan who has done a lot of work, service to the globe, not just East Africa, not just Kenya, but globally. He has done a lot of work. And this is in the area of maritime. I'm just going to allow him to just introduce himself as he joins in, because he can do that better than myself. Welcome to the show, Brother Juvenal Shund.
Thank you very much, my brother Julius, for hosting me this morning or this afternoon or evening, depending on which part of the world you are. Like you said, my name is Juvenal Shundu. I'm a Kenyan, but more so I've spent most of my time serving the global world in the maritime industry. By training, I'm a naval architect. For the last almost 23 years, I was working with the United Nations International Maritime Organization, whose headquarters is in London. I was based here in London for many years, and working at the headquarters and serving the world in the area of maritime. For those of you who might not know, International Maritime Organization is a United Nations agency that regulates shipping, marine pollution, and facilitation of maritime trade. Just like many of you would know, when you talk of Food and Agricultural Organization, which is in Rome, you talk of World Health Organization, which regulates health, ILO, which regulates labor, but IMO regulates maritime, which very few people get to know, more people know about aviation, because everybody flies by air. They see the airports. So when you they see the planes, so when you talk about aviation, everybody knows. But when you talk about maritime, most people associate maritime with ports. And therefore, I hope that in this program, I will share some insights with what maritime really is, and what it does to the world trade, and what it does to developing countries like Kenya, like the rest of the African countries. Thank you. I'll let you lead the show.
Yeah, indeed. Mr. Shiundu, the thing is that a lot of people, they like good stories. They like success. But sometimes they're like, I just want that. But you don't climb the tree from the top. And probably then if it's okay, just share with us how you began this journey. For example, when you were a young man, if someone said to you, what would you want to be when you grow up?
As a young man, if you asked me what I wanted to be, I wanted to be a Catholic priest.
Wow.
And indeed, I went to the seminary and spent some time in seminary. And then when I left seminary, I joined a technical school, and I wanted to be an engineer. And then when I went to Mombasa to do my A-levels, that was the first time I visited a ship. Somebody invited me. My brother-in-law, who was an engineer, electrical engineer on a ship, which was called MV Uganda at the time. That's the time when East African National Shipping Line, owned by Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia, were trading, and they had a number of ships that used to trade globally. So he invited me on board the ship, and that was the first time that I stepped on the ship, and I was fascinated by the ship. And straight away on that same day, I said, no, I want to be a marine engineer to work on the ship. So when I finished my A-levels, knowing that marine engineering was not one of the subjects being taught at Nairobi University, which was the only university in Kenya at the time, I started applying for opportunities to go abroad and study marine engineering. And then later on, I was introduced to one of the shipyards that builds ships in Kenya, and they called me in for an interview, and at that time, the managers were all Wazungus. And they told me, okay, we don't have a chance for somebody to do marine engineering, but we have a chance to sponsor somebody to do naval architecture to come and replace an expatriate who was to retire. So I asked them, what is naval architecture? They said, oh, naval architecture is the design of ships. I had never heard of it before. But then he said, okay, if you are interested, we will interview, and if you pass, I'd just finished my A-levels, we will sponsor you to university. So they took me to the drawing office to give me an interview. And fortunately for me, I had done engineering drawing in technical school. So they put there some drawings of ships, which I was seeing them for the first time, but I could understand, I could read the drawings. And then they interviewed me in mathematics. So I said, fine, you've passed the interview. You have to be very good in mathematics in order to study naval architecture. Fortunately, for my A-levels, I'd done pure maths, applied maths, and physics. So they said, fine, if you're good in maths, doing a double maths and physics, then you can study naval architecture. So that's how I got into the field, and they sponsored me to the UK. So I studied naval architecture and shipbuilding, finished, came back to Kenya, joined the shipyard. The expatriate I was to take over from retired, and went back to UK, and then I started working for them. So that's how I ended up in the field and became the first naval architect, not only in Kenya, but in Eastern, Southern, and Central Africa.
Wow. You see, to most of us who haven't a lot of knowledge in shipping, sometimes when we talk about architecture, you're thinking about that architect is building houses, designing houses. So therefore, this is a biggie when you talk about shipping, and you are the architect, and you became the first Kenyan naval architect. What does it entail, this particular career, being a naval architect?
Well, a naval architect is, like I said, is basically the design of ships. But then when I came back to Kenya and I joined the shipyard, which was called African Marine and General Engineering Company, they were building ships and also repairing ships. But they were more into repairs than building, because that was a time that we had a lot of foreign exchange controls. So if you wanted to build a new ship, it means you have to import almost 100% of the materials from abroad. And at that time, to get foreign exchange to buy equipment or material or even shipbuilding steel or engines, you had to apply through Central Bank and go through a lot of procedures. So more and more, we found that we were having more difficulties trying to import material for new construction of ships. So we ended up doing more repairs than new buildings. So it was then that I realized that if I had to use more of my knowledge, then I had to go and do more studies than remain in, you know, in Kenya. So I went then to do my master's. So I went to Sweden and did a master for science in maritime safety administration, which was now more or less becoming like a regulator of the industry rather than a practitioner. So I specialized in administration, maritime administration, and also dealing with the regulatory aspect, which basically means surveys and inspections of ships, and also ensuring that the ships that are built or operated meet the international international standards. So after that, I came back to Kenya and worked with Kenya Ports Authority for about 2 years. And then I went back to the same shipyard now to start a commercial and marketing department for the shipyard.
Great. What a journey, and what a way to start. I'm happy at least the journey to the shipyard with your brother again? It just opened your eyes to a career that you have really done justice to.
That was my brother-in-law.
Your brother-in-law, yeah.
This is Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, DermaDew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, DermaDew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. DermaDew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
You know, today we are here not just to focus on your career path, more than what you have achieved. As a Kenyan, you have achieved a lot in your field. You have achieved a lot. You know, it's congratulations, because as we are speaking, your story, the very latest, top on the line, and you've been given Liveryman of London, which is really amazing achievement. Do you want to talk to us about that? Because actually, it's the most latest thing in 2023. And again, congratulations.
Thank you very much. I think on 27th of January, which was last Friday, I got my liveryman of the City of London through the Honorable Company of Master Mariners. You see, within the City of London, there are 110 what you call livery companies. And not many people get to know about the livery companies. They are very, very ancient. They go back to, you know, thousands of years when livery companies were formed. because every trade is like what you call these days, if you are an engineer or you are a banker or you are an architect or a lawyer, you belong to some law society or you belong to engineer society. So in the past, the people that operated in the city of London had to belong to a guild. So if you are a goldsmith, you belong to the goldsmith's guild. If you are a fishmonger or if you are, for every trade, it had, its guild. And this sort of became what they call livery companies. And you could not trade in the city of London unless you are a member of a livery company. And to become a livery means you had to serve your apprenticeship, you had to master your grade, your trade before you are admitted now as a fully qualified. So you then belong to a livery company. So within the city of London, you have the Lord Mayor, for example. To elect a Lord Mayor of London, you have to be a liveryman, or to qualify to stand for a senior post in the city of London, you have to be a liveryman, to stand for a sheriff or to stand for an alderman of London. So the Honorable Company of Master Mariners, for which I belong to, for many years, Britain was known as the country that ruled the oceans, that controlled the world. So the merchant fleet was part and integral part of the British Empire, because the British Empire historically went round the world, using the merchant fleet. So the Honorable Company of Master Mariners is the one where the master mariners or pilots of vessels or so forth belonged to it. And indeed, it is the only of the 110 livery companies. It is the one that had the royal charter, and the Queen was a patron from 1952 until she died last year. She was our patron of the Honorable Company, and also the Duke, the late Duke of Edinburgh, was the admiral of our Honorable Company. And indeed, in 1953, he was a master of our Honorable Company. And in 2006 or so, Princess Royal was actually the master of our Honorable Company. So we have a very rich history, the Honorable Company of Master Mariners, with the royal family. So it was indeed, I have been a member before, but I wasn't a liveryman. So it's only on Friday that I became a liveryman, in addition to having received my freedom of the City of London in 2019 in recognition of my work for international diplomacy and maritime.
Tell us a bit more about the Freedom of London Key 2019.
Well, again, the Freedom of London or the Freedom of the City is again something that you get either by patronage. In other words, if your father was a freeman of London, if you are born when your father is already a freeman, you could qualify to be, to be one, or you could, qualify by invitation. Looking at the work that you have done, then you could be invited to become a freeman of London. So I got mine by invitation. So in the olden days, only if you had the freedom to the City of London, could you come and carry out trade within the one square mile in the city. Indeed, there's always a joke when people say, when you say you are you have a freedom to the City of London, people would say, oh, does it mean you are allowed to walk with the ship across the London Bridge? But it is because in the old days, the people who traded in the city, the people who sold the ship were very rich people. And they are the ones that would now come with the ship and walk with the ship across the the London Bridge bringing the ship to the market to sell. And therefore, people always associate that. And in fact, there's a ceremony once every year. There's a procession with the Lord Mayor of London where people walk with the, symbolically walk across the city of London with the, you know, with the ship. And then there's also another joke that goes that in the olden days, if you had the freedom to the city of London, or if you're a freeman of London, and the police found you drunk, the police couldn't arrest you, but they could put you in the car and drive you to your house and knock the door and deliver you to your wife.
Yeah.
So those were some of the privileges that the free men enjoyed those days, but yeah. Not anymore. Yeah.
If you're drunk, you're arrested. Drunk and disorderly.
Yes. Yeah.
No, it's amazing. A lot of it's kind of confusing though, because for people who don't know these traditions, British traditions and all, their thinking is like, what does it mean? I thought I was a free man. I could go anywhere in London.
Yeah. But not so. I mean, these days at least. You can Google and get all this information. If you Google, you know, freedom of the city of London or freeman of London. But in the olden days, it was guarded, so you couldn't get the access to this kind of information.
Privileges and information.
But the livery companies, in fact, hopefully, Julius, I will invite you to some of these when they have the dinners or lunches and so forth. And you find that within the city, the livery companies were very rich. They were very wealthy.
Yeah.
Some of the most magnificent buildings that you find in in London are owned by the livery companies.
Wow.
And you go to those buildings, you go inside it and wonder that, do these buildings really exist? One of the most magnificent building in the city is the one owned by the goldsmith's livery. It's a building whereby if you go there for dinner or lunch or whatever, you would never see anywhere the same amount of gold that is in the building. So hopefully one of these days I'll invite you to it. Yeah.
You never know, one day I may be lucky to be a livery member.
Yeah, why not? Every journey starts with a step, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, our listeners, this is Africa in Focus. Of course, we talk about Africa and we talk about the things that matter to us. We talk about maritime is big, really big, and honored again to host my great friend Juvenal Shiundu, who has done a lot of justice to that particular area, maritime, some over 22 years in, working, serving the world through United Nations and many other aspects. Therefore, you keep joining us. You can send your comments on Facebook. We are live on Facebook as well. We are usually live across the UK every Tuesday, 9 a.m. and also 6 p.m. UK time. So keep an eye on us and join us one of the days. But for now, feel free to send your messages on Facebook. And of course, we'll catch up with your observations as much as we can. Back to to ourselves here in the studio. Yeah, look at it this way. Yeah, you served IMO for many years, 22 years and plus. But of course, it's been a journey. I know along the way, there are those like iconic moments. I know also you've traveled a lot. Maybe what does it mean to serve in your position within the IMO? What came across? Are there things that stand out, things you remember?
Well, one thing I must say, if you now that being Africa and talking about Africa, is that Africa lags behind in terms of maritime. When I came to IMO, one of my briefs was to see to it that more and more African countries participate more in IMO affairs. Because it was realized that Africa really lagged behind. A lot of countries did not participate in many of IMO meetings. Now, if you look at the continent of Africa, you find that the continent of Africa, 38 of the African countries are coastal countries. If you look at the African coastline, you find that the African coastline is actually has got 26,000 kilometers of coastline, if you take the coastline around Africa. So that means that Africa is really a big island. And if it is a big island, then it means that maritime is very important. And when you look at maritime, it's 90% of the world trade goes by sea. So even from the African perspective, 90% of our goods come by sea. But in terms of participation, then you find that the African countries do not participate in the carriage of their own fleet. You find that most of the fleet that carry our goods, both import and exports, are foreign-owned fleet. In the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of effort made for African countries to own ships. And indeed, within the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, they came up with a convention that was called the UNCTAD Liner 40-40-20, which was meant to encourage African countries to own vessels. As we talk, less than 1.2% of the world fleet is owned by the African countries. And yet, if you look at the African population is growing every year. If you look at the imports through our ports, the African continent has more than 100 ports. So a lot of goods come in, go out. But yet these goods are carried by foreign ships.
Colorful radio.
Colorful radio.
So one of the things that I've been advocating for many years is to see how African countries can participate more in the carriage of their own goods. In fact, when Ghana, which was the first African countries to get independence, when they got independence, Kwame Nkrumah had a vision way back in 1957. He established what was called the Black Star Shipping Line. And in fact, many of the African first Africans to go to sea and become pilots, they sailed with the Black Star Line. So if leaders like Kwame Nkrumah could have a vision way back in the 50s that Africa must participate in its own trade, and then yet you find that as we speak in 2023, even the fleet that was owned by Black Star Line is no longer there. I spoke earlier about East Africa National Shipping Line, of which in 1978, the first ship that I went to was owned by East Africa National Shipping Line. But now it doesn't exist anymore. Nigeria had a very big shipping line. You know, it doesn't exist. So we've been making Kenya, for example, back home. I was appointed by President Uhuru Kenyatta in May 2019 to be chairman of Kenya National Shipping Line with efforts to revive the shipping line. And for the last 3 years, we tried very hard to restructure the shipping line so that at the moment, Kenya doesn't have a shipping line, for example. Ethiopia, which is landlocked, has got a very big shipping line, and yet it has no port. It uses the port of, Djibouti. So there was a potential for Kenya National Shipping Line to be revived, to participate in international trade. So I'm only hoping that the new government that has come in will look at it and try to revive the shipping line. In 2013, the African Union came up with what they called Integrated African Maritime Strategy 2050. In other words, they looked at 50 years to come and said, why can't Africa participate in the international trade with all these opportunities? So they came up with the what we call M strategy, M 2050 strategy. So in that strategy, the issue of blue economy came up for the first time. They started talking about the blue economy because that is where the future is. If you look at the oceans, apart from shipping, you've got minerals, you've got fisheries, you've got renewable energies that can come from the oceans, you've got the ocean winds, you've got seaweed. So a lot of things can come from the oceans. And that is why they started looking at the oceans as the next economy for the future. So I can only hope that more and more African countries would be able to look at that. During my tenure at IMO, I was able to establish or help establish three IMO regional presence offices in Africa. The first one was in Kenya, which is at Kigiri. That is the office for the Eastern and Southern Africa region. The second one I opened was in Ghana. In 1999. And the third one was in Cote d'Ivoire for the Western, the West Africa Francophone countries. So I was able to assist 15 African countries establish autonomous maritime administration, including South African Maritime Safety Administration, including Kenya Maritime Authority, Ghana Maritime Authority, all because of my initiative. So I was glad that for my tenure at IMO, I made some improvement on the African maritime scene.
Oh, that's great work. That's really great work. Then again, when you talk about these success in administration, your impact on IMO. Of course, we also remember that you vied to be the Secretary General for IMO. Would you like to share with us that? How was it? Was it any challenges?
Well, in 2015, during the IMO election, I was actually the African Union endorsed candidate for the post of IMO Secretary General. It was very competitive. We had six candidates. We went through a round of voting, and finally, I think. I dropped out at the fifth round of voting, but it gave me a lot of insights, a lot of experience in how international diplomacy works. This year, of course, there is another IMO election, which will be, in July.
Go for it.
Africa already... Kenya has already put forward a candidate, so the closing date for nominations will be 31st of March. Kenya has a candidate by the name Mrs. Nancy Karigithu, the former permanent or principal secretary of State Department of Shipping, and of course she's been endorsed by the other African countries. So we are hoping that if she's elected, she will become the first African, not only the first African, but also the first woman Secretary General of IMO. So we are wishing her well, and we are hoping that Kenya will go behind and really lobby for her election, because by the end of the day, it depends on how well your country lobbies for you. It doesn't depend on the individual, but on the country.
So there's a lot of lobbying involved internationally.
There's a lot of lobbying, and there's a lot of cutting deals diplomatically, where you say, okay, vote for us here, we shall vote for you here, or vote for us here, we shall give you aid here, we shall give you, there is a lot of, that's where you know that at international level, everything depends on scratch my back.
I scratch
your back. That's the bottom line.
It reminds me when I went to Egypt and I had paid for a package from the hotel, and the first thing the driver tells me, the driver of the car that I had already paid for, he said to me, "If you take care of me, I'll take care of you." Yeah. And I'm like, "I only take care of small babies. Are you? What do you mean?" But I know what you mean. It's like give and take, and lobbying does that quite a lot.
Yes, yeah.
Some negotiations, you know, like, we can support you, these support us in this.
Yes.
Yeah. So therefore, in your many years at IMF, are there challenges that you remember, or even globally, that really caught your attention?
Well, the challenges is all depends on, international diplomacy and special interest, because developed countries have their interests, developing countries have their own interest. So you find that when there are, matters to be discussed, countries take position depending on their special interest. The delegates, who might be technical people discussing about technical subjects, but they always end up receiving instructions from capital based on political or special interest. For example, I'll tell you, when issues of climate change were being discussed, when you come to issues of climate change, you talk about greenhouse gas emissions. You are talking about air pollution. Then you find that the developing countries are saying that we need to industrialize. You developed countries have already industrialized. And while you are industrializing, you are emitting gases.
Yeah.
But now that you have industrialized, you are telling us that we should all have the same level of control. So you have to let us reach where you have reached before you can actually, control. So you find then that when they are talking about having limits to the gases, then you find that big developing countries like Brazil, like India, would take a certain position, and they want developing countries to support them. But then, and China, because when it comes to international relations, China would like to say we are developing, but when it comes in other sectors, China is a superpower.
And is developed already.
Yeah, but when it suits them, say, we are still, developing. We still need to develop our industry. So these issues of climate change and greenhouse gas emission, now they call it carbonization. They call it carbonization because the ships were propelled using heavy fuel. Now they are saying that in order to control the gases that the ships burn, they have to limit the sulfur content in the fuel. And if they have to limit the sulfur content, it means the refineries that refine the fuel that ships use have got to have the technology that can be able to manufacture that fuel with less sulfur content. The engines that are supposed to propel these ships have got to be designed to take the new level of fuel. So when it comes to that, then you find that who are the manufacturers of the engines? They are the developed countries.
In developed countries, yeah.
They are the ones with the, with the technology. They are the ones with the ships. The developing countries, the only thing we have
is Dubai.
We have the ports for these ships to come into, into our ports. But then they talk about that when these ships come into the port, they have to switch off the engines. Because if they are in the port and the engines are running, it means that they are polluting the local ports where they are. So if they have to switch off the engine, it means that they have to be supplied power by the port. But if you find most of the developing countries, for example, in Kenya, we have a lot of power shortages, even to meet our domestic needs. Kenya Power and Lighting, half the time, people don't have power. And when they do, the energy is very expensive. So if you now say that ships coming into the port of Mombasa switch off the engine and then you supply them with shore power. So if the country does not have enough power, then how are you going to supply the ships with the shore power? So these are some of the
issues,
being discussed now that affect shipping, but finally they affect the land.
This is Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, DermaDew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, DermaDew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. DermaDew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
Indeed, and I think, as you rightly put it, Africa, we are lacking a bit behind.
Yes, and we need to do more because technology will not wait for us. Look at mobile banking. I mean, Kenya sort of leads the world in mobile banking.
Very true.
So it didn't have to sit and say, let the developing countries do it first. It means when it comes to technology, even as a developing country, you can actually move.
Innovate and go forward.
And overtake. But the irony is most of the countries start saying, oh, yes, if Japan has not done this, then who are we, Tanzania, to do it? Because even Japan hasn't done it. Now, if Kenya was to have waited, because a lot of these technological changes need regulation. Because if you remember, Julius, for Kenya to have done what it did with mobile banking, the country had to deregulate the banking regulations. If they didn't do it at the time they did, we would not have M-Pesa.
Exactly.
And it's the same thing with the digitalization. We're talking about Internet of Things. We're talking about blockchain. All this is technology that is there, and every country can look at that technology and take that technology and run with it. You can't wait.
Yeah.
We're talking about, blockchain. Right now, they're talking about autonomous ships.
Yeah.
They're talking about a ship that can leave the port of Mombasa and go up to the port of Los Angeles without a single person on board. So this technology already exists. But then the regulation has to change because when you talk about taking that autonomous ship from Mombasa to Los Angeles, we've got international regulations on collision.
Yeah.
So before you change that, because that says every ship has got to be manned, every ship of a certain size.
Their policies?
Yeah.
Health and safety?
That's right.
Yeah, when there's no one there, what does that mean, even health and safety-wise?
Yeah. So you find that technology is ahead of regulation.
Yeah.
It's like, say, fine, you can fly a plane from London to go and land in New York without a pilot.
Yeah.
But it's possible with the technology. But then if the regulations say that
no one manned.
Some years back, I think 2 years back, they were saying that they were testing Uberless cars.
Yeah.
And then they tested, I think, somewhere in the US, and the car had an accident.
Yeah.
But it was possible for you to call an Uber. The Uber comes to your address. It has no
driver.
You get into it. It takes you to where you're going. But in order for that Uber to operate, it means you have to change your highway code. Because exactly. If the highway code says every car must have a driver and every driver should have a license,
yeah,
should be licensed. Yeah. So then how are you going to say you can have a driverless car? Yeah.
That car doesn't have anyone with a driving license.
That's right, yes. And this is what is happening in shipping. Technology is there now. Countries like Norway, for example, they have, ships that are carrying fertilizers, but because they are operating within their own waters from one port to the other, they carry these fertilizers. They can move from one port to the next port carrying fertilizers without without a pilot.
But just because they're operating within their own territory.
That's right,
If it goes international, then there's lots of other regulations they have to adhere to.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of technology, because technology doesn't have to wait for a developed or a developing country. Any country can come and say, we take this technology and we move with it.
Yeah. When you talk about blue economy, it's a key thing. And it's like the currency now being talked about, blue economy. But of course, we shared here in this show that Africa is lacking a bit behind. Do you think probably the West has head start, way ahead of everyone, and Africa, we have to play a catching up?
No, when it comes to, in fact, when it comes to blue economy, Africa came up with a blueprint on blue economy before the EU. Well before the EU, the African countries had a document continental-wise on the blue economy. And like I said, for example, Seychelles leads the world in blue economy implementation. But Seychelles is a developing country. But the main reason is that when the word blue economy first came up when we were preparing for the Rio Plus 20 conference, because during the preparation of the Rio Plus 20 conference in 2011, there were four preparatory meetings leading up to the conference. And I happened to have gotten a chance to attend all the four preparatory meetings. So they were talking about the green economy. At that time, the focus was that we're going to Rio Plus 20, and we need to know how the world can use more efficient resources on the green economy. But then small island states like, Seychelles, Palau, Solomon Islands, they came up and said, no, ours is not a green economy. Ours is blue economy because we are surrounded by oceans and our livelihood depends on the oceans and on sustainability of the oceans. So then the world realized, actually, they have a point because they don't deal with the green economy. So they managed to push. So when we went to Rio in 2012, June, the small island states pushed very hard for the outcome document, which was the future we want, to come up with a chapter on oceans. And shortly after that, they had a conference in Abu Dhabi. I think it was in January 2013. That was the first international conference on the blue economy, but it was championed by Seychelles. So you find that in the whole world, Seychelles has done more on the blue economy than any other country. And that's why I said earlier that some of these things that are coming up, we don't have to wait for X to happen before Y. You could actually
change the alphabet.
Yeah,
of development.
Quantum leap. Yeah, like for example, previously with the landlines. You remember, Julius, when you had to apply, for example, in Kenya, to apply for Kenya Post and Telecommunication to come and give you a line, and they would tell you they don't have posts, they don't have these, they don't have these. You could take 2 years waiting for a line. Yeah. And then mobile phones came up, and somebody could go to a mobile shop and pay and be connected the same day.
Straight away.
So we were able, villages that had not been connected to the landlines were able to be connected to, to the mobile technology.
Yeah.
So they didn't wait to get a landline before they got
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that Africa we need to look at.
Yeah.
That if there is technology that we can actually quantum leap,
yeah,
we should be able to do it.
We go for it.
Yeah.
And we lead the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of the near future now, do you have plans to advance this, or are you you know your career of 22 years experience and all that, but are you kind of saying that I want to do something else, or you have other plans to further this journey?
Yeah, like I said earlier, when I left IMO, I was appointed by the president to be a chair of Kenya National Shipping Line. Which I appreciated the position. I did my best. My term ended. So now I have, with a group of friends, founded a company called Maritime and Blue Economy Insights Limited. We are doing consultancies, not only in Africa, but globally. So that is what is going to keep me busy for the foreseeable future.
No, that sounds good. Mm. That sounds good. I don't want to ask, but I'm sure on the way you may have mentored a few people here and there.
Well,
within the industry.
I have mentored many people, and I still continue to mentor, not only in worldwide. I have a lot of people that I mentor worldwide, and every day I keep responding to emails and people asking questions in this area and this area and so forth. And I enjoy it because I believe that knowledge not shared is wasted.
Very so true.
I believe in sharing the knowledge, because the only knowledge is good is the knowledge that is shared. And I continue doing that.
That's really good. So in terms of then, what would you save? Of course, now we have these African countries. We are like, they can do better than they are doing already. What would be your advice for the future and the venture within the either blue economy or maritime, whichever aspect we focus on?
Well, the thing is, in Africa, unfortunately, you can't divorce development with politics. Everything hinges with politics. So, if you separate politics to development, then things can move. If you talk about Africa, you find when you talk about African ports, then they are very sensitive. Every politician wants to control the port. So the ports are looked at as very lucrative income generators. And therefore, the appointments of CEOs of ports in Africa has been politicized, which is very unfortunate. I mean, I've been in cases where we were having meetings with the director general of ports in Africa. They have come with their ministers, and while we were at the meeting, they have been sacked. So the minister is trying to persuade that let the announcement not be made, because I've gone out, I'm on a meeting with the DG, but now, and how do you sack the DG when we are in an international meeting? I've been through this several times with a number of, I could write a book on African ports. So if you look at the case of Kenya, for example, Kenya Ports Authority, you look at it and say it is the most politicized CEO of all parastatals. No CEO lasts for long. Why is that? But if a port is a very big, important thing in the economy, so once you politicize it, it has an effect. And therefore, when you talk about maritime, in most African countries, the port comes first. And if the port comes first, everybody wants to know who is the DG or the whatever. I've got an example. There's only one port, which I know, where a DG served for 9 years.
Only one?
9 years, one DG. That is on record as the longest serving DG of an African port. Because in most African countries, you are lucky to serve for 2 terms. If 1 term is 5 years or 4, you are even lucky to serve for that. And once you politicize that, then when you are talking about growing the blue economy, then you have to let the sector, the market forces, determine but not control it. So that is one thing I would like to
share.
Yeah.
No, that's very valuable indeed. And politicization of ports, not a great way to go. I think professionalization may be the best alternative to politicization. So wonderful, wonderful. Really appreciate your time. Thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll keep bringing you back from time to time, depending on where you are.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to be with you in this show. So listeners,
colorful radio.
For your girl, are you insane?
See, I know that you may be just a bit jealous of me, but you're blind if you can't see that love is all in me.
See, I tried to hesitate. I didn't want to say what she told me. She said without me, she couldn't make.